Now regarding the collection for the saints, as I gave order to the churches of Galatia, so you should also do. Having finished his discussion about doctrines and preparing to transition to morals, he puts aside everything else and moves to the primary virtue, discussing charity. Yet he doesn't speak about morals in a broad sense, but focuses solely on this issue, then stops. This is noticeably different from his usual method, as in the other epistles he concludes with charity, temperance, meekness, patience, and the rest. So, why does he only address this part of practical morality here? It's because most of the previous discourse was ethical in nature. When he chastised the person engaged in sexual immorality, when he was correcting those who resort to lawsuits among non-believers, when he warned the drunkards and the gluttons, where he condemned the divisive, the argumentative, and those who craved dominance, where he handed those who approached the sacraments unworthily over to that severe judgment, where he spoke about love. Because of these reasons, the issue he felt most urgent, namely the needed support for fellow believers, is the sole matter he mentions here. And notice his consideration. Once he had convinced them about the resurrection, fueling their enthusiasm, only then does he engage with this point further. Indeed, he had previously discussed these matters with them, stating, "If we have sowed spiritual things among you, is it so much if we reap your carnal things?" And, "Who plants a vineyard and does not eat its fruit?" However, recognizing the significant nature of this moral accomplishment, he does not decline to bring it up again near the end of his letter. And he refers to the collection as Logion, essentially making it clear from the beginning that the things are simple. For when everyone contributes together, that which each person is responsible for becomes light. But after discussing the collection, he didn't immediately say, "Let each of you set aside in storage," even though this is naturally expected. But after first stating, "As I directed the churches of Galatia," he included this, sparking their competitive spirit by sharing examples of others doing well and shaping it into a narrative. He did this too when writing to the Romans. To them, while seemingly explaining why he was heading to Jerusalem, he introduces his discussion on charity. "But now I'm going to Jerusalem, serving the saints, because Macedonia and Achaia felt it was fitting to make a particular contribution for the poor among the saints." But in that case, he motivates them by referring to Macedonians and Corinthians, in this case, Galatians. His statement, "As I directed the churches of Galatia, so also do you," was sure to make them feel shamed to ever be found lacking compared to the Galatians. And he doesn't just say, "I advised" or "I counseled," but "I directed," which carries more authority. And he doesn't use a single city or two or three, but an entire nation. He also does this in his theological directives, stating, "just like in all the churches of the saints." For if this is powerful enough to solidify doctrines, it's even more so for encouraging imitation of actions. What then, I ask, did you give orders about? Vertu. On the first day of the week, which is the Lord's Day, each one of you should save up money according to your prosperity. Notice how he encourages them, relating it to time. The day itself should inspire them to be charitable. He says, "Remember what you achieved on this day. All the indescribable blessings and the starting point of our life occurred on this day." However, it's not just the appropriate time for acting generously, but it's also a day of rest and a break from all work. The souls free from labor are more willing and capable of showing compassion. Additionally, partaking in such profound and lasting mysteries on that day inspires great zeal. Therefore, each one of you, not just one or two people, but every one of you, poor or rich, woman or man, slave or free, should save up money. He didn't say, "bring it to church," so they wouldn't feel embarrassed if the amount is small, but "accumulate your donation gradually, then present it when I arrive. But for now, save it," he says. "At home, make your house a church, your little box a treasury. Be a custodian of sacred wealth, a self-appointed steward of the poor. Your generous spirit grants you this priesthood. Even today, this is a sign of our wealth, but the sign remains, the thing itself is nowhere." Now, I am aware that many of you in this congregation will again criticize me when I discuss these topics, asking, "Please don't be harsh and unpleasant to your listeners. Understand their mindset. Allow for the thoughts of your audience, for in doing so, you indeed make us feel embarrassed. You cause us to blush. But I cannot stand such words, because Paul was not ashamed to continuously focus on these themes, to use language similar to that of beggars. I acknowledge that if I said, "Give it to me," or "store it in my house," then there might perhaps be something to blush about with my words, though this would still be debatable. For as the text states, those who serve the altar receive their share from the altar, but someone might criticize this as if it's an argument in my own favor. However, right now I'm appealing on behalf of the poor. In fact, more so for your sake, the gift givers. Hence, I am not afraid to speak out. Is it really so shameful to urge you to feed your Lord in his hunger, clothe him in his nakedness, or welcome him as a stranger? Your Lord, who needs nothing and wants for nothing, is not ashamed to publicly declare, "I was hungry and you did not feed me." And should I be hesitant or feel shame? Absolutely not. This shame is a trap of the devil. So I will not feel shame. Instead, I will boldly say, "Give to those in need," and I will say it louder than the needy themselves. It is indeed true. If someone could prove that by saying these things we are attracting you to ourselves, and under the guise of helping the poor we are making a profit, such behavior would not only be worthy of shame, but equally deserving of condemnation. If, on the other hand, by God's grace, we are not causing any trouble to anyone, but instead offering the scriptures free of charge, working not at all like Paul, but being content with our own, then with complete confidence I will say, "Give to the needy." Moreover, I will not refrain from saying it, and will fiercely condemn those who don't give. Just as a general would not be ashamed to demand food for his soldiers, I am not ashamed to passionately advocate for your salvation. But to make my argument both more persuasive and effective, I will follow in the footsteps of Paul and similarly say, "Let each of you set aside savings according to his prosperity." Now pay attention to how he sidesteps becoming a burden. He did not dictate a specific amount or percentage, but suggested according to his prosperity, whether it be a lot or a little. He didn't say, "whatever anyone has earned," but "as he may prosper," implying that it's God who provides. And he doesn't command them to deposit everything at once, making his advice more manageable, as the gradual collection of savings minimizes the burden and cost. This also explains why he does not require them to offer it all at once, but gives them ample time. Explaining the reason, he said, "that there be no collections when I come," implying you should not wait until it's time to contribute before you start accumulating. This attitude, to a considerable extent, offered them encouragement. The anticipation of Paul's arrival, sure to make them more committed. "And when I arrive, whoever you approve, I will send them with letters to carry your generosity to Jerusalem." He didn't say this person and that, but whomever you approve, whomever you choose, thereby freeing his ministry from suspicion. Therefore, he gives them the right to vote in the choice of those who are to convey it. He is far from saying, "The payment is yours, but the privilege of selecting those who will distribute it is not yours." Then, so they won't think him absent, he includes his letters saying, "Whomever you approve, I will send with letters." It's like he said, "I will also be with them and participate in the ministry through my letters." And he didn't say, "I will send these people to deliver your charitable donations," but "your generosity," to indicate they were doing important deeds, to suggest they were benefiting themselves. Elsewhere, he called it both a blessing and a distribution, the one to ensure they're not demotivated, the other to prevent arrogance. But he never referred to it as charity. "And if it is appropriate for me to also go, they will go with me." Here again, he encourages them towards generosity, saying, "If it's necessary for me to be present as well, I won't hesitate." But he didn't initially promise this, nor say, "When I arrive, I will deliver it." For he wouldn't have emphasized it so much if he had stated it outright from the beginning. However, he adds it appropriately and timely later on. So, the reason he didn't immediately promise nor completely kept silent about it is clear. After saying, "I will send," he eventually includes himself too. Similarly, he leaves the decision up to them by saying, "If it's fitting for me to go as well." This depended upon them, mainly to increase their collective contribution, large enough even to alter his plans and cause him to personally make the journey. But I will come to you, he says, once I've travelled through Macedonia. He had mentioned this before, but then it was with anger. He even added, And I will know not the speech of those that are arrogant, but their power. But this time he states it more gently, so that they might even look forward to his arrival. Then, to prevent them from asking, Why do you favour the Macedonians above us? He didn't say, When I depart, but After I've passed through Macedonia, for I'm just passing through Macedonia. Verse 6. But I may stay with you, or even winter there. For I don't merely wish to see you in passing, but to spend some time with you. When he wrote this letter, he was in Ephesus during winter. As you can tell from this line, I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost. After this, I'll travel to Macedonia, and once I've journeyed through it, I would be with you in the summer, and perhaps I might even spend the winter with you. Why did he say, perhaps, and not confirm it outright? Because Paul didn't know everything, and had good reasons for it. Hence he doesn't say it with surety, so that if it doesn't happen, he still has an explanation. First, his earlier reference to it was vague, and second, the power of the Spirit guided him wherever it wished, not where he wanted to go. He also conveyed this in his second letter, when he excused his delay, saying, Or do I make my plans in a worldly manner, so that in the same breath I say both yes, yes, and no, no? So that you may support me on my journey wherever I go. This too is a sign of love and profound strength of feeling. For I do not want to see you just in passing, for I hope to stay a while with you if the Lord allows. Now he said these things, both to show his love and also to scare the sinners, not openly though, but with an external display of friendship. Verse 8, but I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost. As we would expect, he tells them all clearly, informing them as friends. For this too is a sign of friendship to explain the reason why he was not with them, why he was late, and where he was staying. For a large and effective door has opened for me, and there are many opponents. Now if it was great, how could there be adversaries? The adversaries were numerous precisely because men's faith was great, because the entrance was great and wide. But what does a great door mean? There are many prepared to accept the faith, ready to approach and be converted. There is a spacious entrance for me, things being now at a point where the minds of those approaching are in their prime for the obedience of faith. This is why the devil's breath blew so fiercely, because he saw many turning away from him. You can see then, for two reasons, it was necessary for him to stay, both because the gain was plentiful and because the struggle was intense. And with this, he also encouraged them, specifically by saying that from this point forward, the word operates everywhere and emerges effortlessly. And if there are many who conspire against it, this too is a sign of the gospel's progress. For never does that evil demon grow fierce, except when seeing his goods being greatly plundered. Therefore, when we aim to accomplish something great and noble, we should not focus on the magnitude of the labor it brings, but rather on the potential gain. Consider, for instance, Paul, who did not hesitate or retreat, even though there were many adversaries. Instead, because there was a great door, he persevered and pressed on. Indeed, as I've said before, this was an indication that the devil was being vanquished, because it's not the small or insignificant deeds that stir up that evil creature's wrath. So, when you see a righteous man performing great deeds and yet enduring countless hardships, don't be surprised. In fact, one might wonder why the devil, being struck so many times, doesn't retaliate or bear the wounds meekly. You wouldn't be surprised if a continuously provoked serpent acted fiercely and attacked its provoker. The devil, like a poised scorpion, rises against all. Don't let this disturb you. As after a war, with its victories and losses, one naturally must bear its wounds. Do your part. And when you see someone performing charitable acts and countless other good deeds, thereby reducing the power of the devil, but then see them falling into temptations and dangers, don't be distressed. Their fall into temptation is precisely because they struck the devil mightily. And how did God allow this, you will ask? For him to be honored even more exceptionally, for the other to be struck a harder blow. For when a man suffers grievously even after receiving blessings, and yet continues to give thanks, it serves as a defeat to the devil. For it's excellent to demonstrate mercy and stick to virtue when everything is going well, but it's even more significant to not quit this commendable pursuit during severe adversity. Such a person can truly say they do so for God's sake. So then, even if we are in danger, beloved, even if we suffer immensely, let's apply ourselves to our quest for virtue with greater enthusiasm. For this isn't the time for requital at all. So let's not ask for our rewards now, because when the rewards come at the right time, we could reduce our compensation. For example, in the case of workers, those who provide for themselves and work earn higher pay, while those who are provided for by their employers have a significant part of their wages cut. The same applies to saints. The one who does immense good and endures horrible evil has their reward intact and a much larger compensation, not only for the good deeds they have done, but also for the evil they have suffered. But the one who enjoys relaxation and luxury here doesn't receive such bright rewards there. So let's not then seek our compensation here. But let us rejoice then, especially when we do good and suffer bad, for God has in store for us in that world not only the reward for our good deeds, but also for our temptations. To clarify my point further, let's imagine two wealthy, compassionate men who give to the poor. Then one remains wealthy and enjoys prosperity, while the other falls into poverty, sickness, and misfortune, but thanks God nonetheless. When these two pass on to the next life, who will receive the greater reward? Isn't it clear that it will be the one who, despite doing well and suffering greatly, did not succumb to human weakness? I believe that's clear to everyone. Truly, this is the unbreakable statue. This is the thoughtful servant. But if we shouldn't do good deeds solely for the hope of the kingdom, but because it pleases God, which is more significant than any kingdom, then what does he deserve? Who becomes more indifferent towards virtue because he doesn't receive his reward here? Let us not be upset then when we see that someone who consistently invited widows to feasts and perpetually hosted events suffer a blow like losing his house in a fire or other similar tragedies. Yes, it is precisely because of this that they will receive their reward. For Job was not so much lauded for his charity as he was exalted for his sufferings afterwards. This is why his friends were looked down upon and considered insignificant, because they were seeking the fortunes of the temporal world, and because of this, they ruled against the righteous man. So let's not seek our reward here. Let's not become poor and needy, since it is incredibly lowly when heaven is the offering and things beyond heaven to be distracted by the things here on earth. Let's definitely not do that. But no matter what unforeseen circumstances befall us, let's consistently follow the commands of God and comply with the blessed Paul's advice. And let's make a small donation box for the poor at home and place it near the location you stand to pray. And every time you come in to pray, first place your charity and then send up your prayer. And just as you wouldn't wish to pray with dirty hands, likewise don't do so without charity. Because even the gospel hanging by our bed isn't more important than your acts of charity being set aside for you. For if you hang up the gospel and do nothing, it won't benefit you much. But if you have this small donation box, you have a defense against the devil, you empower your prayer, you make your home sacred, having food for the king stored there. And for this reason, let the donation box also be placed near the bed, and the night will not be troubled with fears. Only make sure that nothing is placed into it, which is the result of injustice. For this act is charity, and it can't be that charity should ever come out of hard-heartedness. Do you also want to know about the resources from which you should make your contributions to make this type of donation easier? For instance, the craftsman, the shoemaker, the leather cutter, or the brass founder, or any other artisan, when he sells any item from his trade, let him give the first fruits of its price to God. Let him contribute a small portion here and earmark a bit for God from his share, even if it's rather sparse. I'm not asking for a lot. Contribute an amount equal to the smallest given by the Jews, despite their multitude of sins. Let us, who look forward to heaven, give just as much. I say this, not as a rule and not to restrict more, but as a recommendation to deposit at least 1/10. Make sure this practice is followed not just in selling, but also in buying and receiving a reward. Landowners should also abide by this rule in handling their rents. Yes, let it become a law for everyone who earns their income honestly. I'm not speaking to those who exploit others by charging interest or soldiers who abuse others and capitalize on their neighbors' misfortunes. God will accept nothing from them. But these principles are for those who earn their living through righteous labor. Yes, and if we develop such a habit, our conscience will continually nag us if we ever forget this rule. In time, we won't even consider it difficult. Gradually, we'll achieve greater things by learning how to disregard wealth and by eliminating the root of all evils. This way, we can live a peaceful life presently and acquire the afterlife. May we all reach that stage.